Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurt Woodsmith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And you know, Julie, I used to, or I still take some of these, you know, sort of health food store supplements for different things, you know.
Yes, I've noticed.
You've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
My large tray of Monday through Friday, and yeah.
Yes, your medicine chest sitting on your desk.
I've scaled down in recent years, but I still take a few things here and there, and I tend to stick to the things I take because I feel like they're helping in some way, shape, or form. Like either it, you know, relaxes me when I'm needing relaxation, or gives me a little bit of increased concentration or energy or what have you, whatever the desired result happens to be. But in the back of my mind, there's always the idea of the placebo effect. And I'm always find myself thinking, now, is this working, or is this, or am I just paying, you know, whatever for a fake little pill and it's all in my mind? And then if it is all in my mind, should I stop or should I keep going to get that placebo effect? Because at what point can you still get, I mean, if you explain away the placebo,
mm-hmm.
then you can't fool, your brain can't fool you into getting that effect, right?
Yeah, I know. And sometimes, I mean, I've had the same thoughts before because I use essential oils sometimes,
mm-hmm.
mainly because they smell nice. But of course, they're supposed to be mood lifting.
Yeah,
and
what is essential about essential oils?
Well, I mean, they're the distilled oil of whatever that thing is. So,
sort of like Gelfling, oil or whatever from the Dark Crystal when they would,
Yes. Yeah. More like lavender.
Oh, okay. So it's like a lavender
rosemary.
Plant condensed to oil.
Yeah.
Okay.
And grapefruit. That's a nice one too.
Oh.
And it does have like a sort of nice uplifting scent.
Okay.
But I have thought before, you know, is this sort of quackery? But at the end of the day, I don't really care because it smells good, right?
Right.
Like if it's just all BS, but you know, the underlying thing here is that my house is going to smell nice. What harm is it doing?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the whole thing about placebo, right? Is we know a little bit about it, right? It makes us feel better in a medical sense. You know, you were talking about an inert pill that someone might take. It's actually a measurable, observable, felt improvement in your health and in your behavior. And
it has pretty wide-reaching ramifications, as we're going to discuss in this podcast episode.
Yeah,
it goes beyond just, you know, me shopping for vitamins or you know getting the oil of a tree. So
yeah, it turns out the placebo effect is driving big pharmaceutical companies crazy, and like never before. And the reason for that is because the placebo effect seems to be increasing in their clinical trials of new drugs.
Oh.
So they're sitting there saying, what was going on here? Like, we used to be able to pass, 19 out of 50 drugs through clinical trials, but now, and this is super crazy, half of the medicines that are coming out of clinical trials are being discounted because of the placebo effect.
Basically, when you go to these clinical trials, the medication has to go up against the placebo and test.
Exactly.
It sounds really straightforward that, hey, for this medication to work, it needs to work better than fake medication.
Right.
Because you have control groups in these. You'll have like group A. Well, let's say you have a new drug that contains, pecans in it or something. I don't know. Imagine some imaginary drug that comes from some plant in South America or something.
But it's a pecan drug.
Yeah, something that is expensive to obtain, something that's costly, something that a lot of research has gone into. A lot of scientists have been hunched over labs and lots of money's gone into developing this pill. So you've got that and you give that to group A to treat their hypertension. And then group B gets this placebo, which is nothing. It's a pill. It's just a pill. It's like basically like a sugar pill.
Yeah.
And it has no actual, there's nothing inside that pill that can actually help them.
Right.
But they're given it, and both groups think they're getting the pricey, researched, possible new super drug to treat their hypertension. So again, it sounds just overly simple, but you want group A, who's taking the real drug, to have better results than the group taking the sugar pill.
Right.
But it's not always the case.
No.
And as you discuss, it's often a surprising amount of the time, it is not the case.
No. And in fact, with antidepressants in particular, mm-hmm. they're finding astounding results, which is that 75% of the drugs that are used in antidepressants are found to be effective, but also 75% of the placebos are also giving people relief.
Mm-hmm.
So that all of a sudden that puts the whole question about medication into a new light, and the approach to actually even testing them or even assessing depression and other disorders. It's actually really blown open the whole placebo effect in general and made big pharma look at placebo in a new way, because before it was sort of like, we just have to get over the placebo effect.
Yeah,
it's a problem.
It was
it's a
the
nuisance.
Boogeyman you had to beat.
Yeah. And there's this great Wired article. It's called Placebos Are Getting More Effective. Drug Makers Are Desperate to Know Why. And they actually call out the fact that this may be an opportunity to actually look at the amazing ability of the body to heal itself.
Yeah, this is the article by Wired's Steve Silberman.
Yeah.
Silberman. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty fascinating to look at the issue. And I wanted just to give a quick history of placebo, though.
Oh, yeah. Now, we're going by Sieber's paper and going back to World War II, right?
Yeah, World War II, basically you have, in Italy, there's an anesthesiologist, I believe.
Yeah, by the name of Henry Beecher.
Yeah, Henry Beecher.
And he's attending to U.S. troops under heavy German bombardment.
Yep.
And when you're treating catastrophic injuries, you need to have morphine on hand.
Right.
So they're pumping.
It's helpful.
Yeah, they're pumping morphine into these guys to deaden the pain while they work on them.
Right.
And they run out of morphine.
Yeah. And a nurse, very savvy nurse that was working with Henry Beecher, basically pretended that she, with a wounded soldier, was giving him an injection of morphine and said, I'm giving you a really potent painkiller. Don't worry, you'll be fine. It was, in fact, only salt water. But what Beecher observed is that the wounded soldier did not go into shock when he had his procedure done, and that the wounded soldier seemed to feel relief. So he saw firsthand the effects of the placebo effect. And later on, when he went back to Harvard after the war, he began to look at it more seriously, and was now investigating the placebo effect against current day medications of that time to see if they were really effective. It was an incredible new idea, actually.
Yeah, in 1955, he put out a paper called The Powerful Placebo, published in the Journal of American Medical Association. And it undermined the results of more than a dozen trials by causing improvement that was mistakenly,
attributed to whatever the medicinal properties were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a huge moment in modern drugs, because suddenly here's the placebo messing up everything that you're trying to do, becoming this hurdle. And like you say, that's kind of the history of it. It becomes this hurdle when perhaps they, that you could argue they should be looking at it and saying, well, why is the placebo working? As
right.
opposed to why are our drugs not working, better than the placebo?
Yeah. And with Beecher, I mean, he was just trying to keep quackery at bay, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was basically just trying to apply this. He wasn't necessarily thinking that this was going to be taken up by Big Pharma, nor could he have ever predicted how big this industry would become.
Yeah.
And as you say, it would become this obstacle for them to, you know, get over. So there you go. That's the history of it. And that's why we have it and we know that it's effective. But that being said, it's been a long time since we've revisited the placebo effect, and particularly in the light of antidepressants and stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about a little bit about that later.
And it still remains a fairly unknown quantity. I mean, scientists continue to try and understand it, but the placebo effect is in many ways still a mystery.
Yeah. And we do know a little bit more, but I mean, the question is, what in the world is really going on in your body when it starts to actually heal itself and give you, albeit temporary relief, right? Like, placebo effect has its limits. It's not going to cure a tumor. But, if you've, say, like, you have Parkinson's or, sexual dysfunction or, sorry for you, and you have maybe depression or something along those lines, we know that those sort of disorders really respond well to placebo effect. So, it was once thought that placebo effect was a result of our own level of gullibility, or even like a psychological trait that was related to neurosis.
Yeah, or like weakness of character kind of thing.
Like, yeah,
give them anything, they'll give them a sugar pill, they'll think they're healed. But it seems more than that. Now, obviously, I mean, we can't go so far as to, you know, scientifically say, well, it's mind over matter. It's anything you believe becomes real, because that's not the case, or no belief is really strong enough to alter physical reality.
Right.
But something's happening.
But we see the belief system working in tandem with the body. So, enter Dr. Fabrizio Benedetti. And he actually calls the placebo effect the placebo response because of its self-healing, and he calls it endogenous healthcare system. After 15 years of research, Benedetti has mapped the biochemical reactions of the placebo effect. And he's found that, and this is again from the Wired article, quote, placebo-activated opioids not only relieve pain, they also modulate heart rate and respiration. The neurotransmitter dopamine, when released by the placebo treatment, helps improve motor function in Parkinson's patients. So it's mechanisms like this that can elevate mood, sharpen cognitive ability, alleviate digestive disorders. IBS is another one that responds well to this, by the way. Relieve insomnia and limit the secretion of stress-related hormones like insulin and cortisol. So he's seeing this in action. And again, we're talking about the placebo effect working in tandem with the mind. And what this is bearing out is that the mind is trying to anticipate the future, right? It's saying, okay, I'm going to take this pill. I've got this condition. And, you know, I already know that, I already know what to expect in terms of relief and even side effects, right?
Right.
And so the mind is actually queuing itself up for this and releasing those opioids, which is amazing. And actually, one of the biggest self-healing triggers is to witness someone else experiencing the benefits of a drug.
Ah.
So again, you have this sort of conditioning response.
Well, you're engaging in this kind of this social activity of the doctor administering something that heals you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, there's a researcher, Ted Kapuch, and he recruited volunteers suffering from IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And they were put into three groups. One group just made an appointment for a treatment, and they found some relief just by the act of signing up for treatment.
Oh, wow.
The other group were given a placebo from a medical professional who did not engage with them at all. And then the third group were given the placebo, but the clinician actually engaged with that group quite a bit, talked to them about their suffering, talked about them, you know, how they felt about it, and gave them some positive feedback. So again, here we go. Like you mentioned, there's this social aspect to it. That group responded the best out of all three.
So the bedside manner of the physician is really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Steve Silberman also points out that the color of the pill even makes a difference.
I know. This is so tricky.
Like yellow pills make the most effective antidepressants. Red pills give you a kick, you know, because it's red, like the blood of a bull or something.
Right, adrenaline.
Yeah. Green reduces anxiety. You know, green is kind of calming. And they say that even like branding, you know, becomes involved in it. Like it's all in the packaging and the delivery. And I mean, the color thing just makes me think, you know, it's just a sufficiently believable physician could just walk into a sick ward with like a bag of Starburst and just start healing people left and right.
Yeah. If you had the association that Starburst were going to make everything better, like, you know, if maybe Starburst had spent $100 million on a campaign trying to link some sort of benefit between the consumption of the chewy stuff stuck in your teeth and your health. One of the other things too that was interesting is that it's cultural. These perceptions are cultural.
Oh yeah, like they're the Germans, right?
Well, not only the Germans, but the Italians, because you were talking about the blue pills and the red pills. And so, of course, the blue pill is supposed to be soothing, right? And the red pill, again, is more of an aggressive thing. But in Italy, the color of the national soccer team is blue. So that's perceived as aggressive in that culture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
huh.
So it comes down, you know, to that level. It's really interesting.
That is fascinating. Like, I wonder how that affects, like, even like international branding. You know?
Oh yeah.
You know, if you have branding for something that you want the consumer to think of it in relaxed terms or soothing terms, and then in Italy you have the angry blue and the victorious soccer team. They get them all riled up.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to wonder how that extends, like, throughout their society. Like, you know, if their apartments are all in blue, if that's thought like, wow, that's like a really aggressive bachelor.
But the Germans in particular, anthropologist Daniel Moorman did a study, and he found that Germans are high placebo reactors in trials of ulcer drugs.
Yeah.
But low in trials of drugs for hypertension. Because hypertension is an undertreated condition in Germany. So again, it's about engaging in this social maze that comes with the treatment of an illness, being aware of its treatment, seeing, success stories either in your life or in the media. Like a lot of it, like, you know, when you think of like anxiety or depression medications, instantly we think of those commercials or I guess it's also even for things like herpes and stuff, but it's like, you know, some smiling person walking through a field and they're happy and they're running and birds are singing.
Yeah.
And it's just driving home, take this and be happy.
And you will be able to go outdoors and frolic. I mean, that's usually the message. Oh, and you'll be surrounded by a bunch of people who love you.
Yeah. It's kind of the same as a Mentos commercial, except they have to add a lot of legal text at the end. Like Mentos doesn't have to have that half a screen of fine.
Yeah. There's no talk of diarrhea in the Mentos commercial, thankfully. But the German example, that is really interesting. Like that makes me think, is it sort of like this, anticipation? Like because it is underreported, what was that? Hypertension is underreported. It's not as big of a deal, maybe, and they're not as conditioned to think as much of it. Is that perhaps?
I think so. Yeah, like it's undertreated. Like it's just not on people's minds as much.
Yeah.
Whereas you know something like depression is very much on everybody's minds. Everybody
right.
like we just have this almost like this cult of the quest for happiness that has been pressed upon us through. Mass media and through, you know, everybody knows somebody who takes something to improve their daily life, whether it's you know, prescribed medication or just some sort of weird you know, herbal thing that they buy from the health food store.
Yeah, it's true. And just to put that in perspective with the statistic, let me see, in 1996 there were 13 million antidepressants doled out, and that has since doubled to 26 million by 2007.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, we all know that that's something that everyone is apt to grapple with at some point. We have plenty of statistics that tell us that, you know, each of us is going to at some point feel maybe acute depression. So it's not surprising that it's on our minds. But again, you know, getting back to the placebo effect and why it may be getting stronger and going back to the commercials that you were talking about, that actually seems to be one of the culprits of why the placebo effect, why people in clinical trials are feeling this conditioning to get better or are actually self-healing. They think that the marketing has just been so great and so rampant that it's really conditioning people to already get in that mindset.
Wow.
And we already have studies that say that when people make an appointment to even do this, they feel better. So that's one area of it. And then another aspect is that the way that they're classifying an illness or a disorder, this is sort of interesting in talking about depression in particular. There's something called the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale, and that was created 50 years ago. And it's based on a study of a major depressive disorder in patients in an asylum. Okay, so you can already tell that there are problems with this scale anyway, because 50 years ago, when we had a different idea of what depression was, in an asylum,
right,
a small sample group. So there are people today that are saying maybe we shouldn't take this scale and use it particularly for disorders that have to do with depression and revisit this, and maybe we'll get a better idea of what the placebo effect is doing if we can redefine what depression is. Sort of an interesting way of looking at it.
Now, there are a couple of other related...
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
Topics on placebo that that are pretty fascinating. One that I ran across, and I imagine you did as well, is the honest placebo.
And this I haven't heard about that.
Well, this is kind of like what I was talking earlier. If I... You know, if I have this, say, you know, I have some sort of herbal thing I buy from the health food store, you know, and I don't know for certain that it's working, but I don't know that it's not working. But if I knew for a fact that it was just a sugar pill, would it still work on me? Well, this is called an honest placebo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is doctors involved in this think that the placebos work because patients think they might be getting an active drug, but there's an element of deception. That's the old version, you know, it's like there's the deception at work that I think this is going to work. So it does, even if it's a sugar pill, right? But in 2010, Harvard researchers found that even when volunteers with severe bowel disease know they're getting a placebo, 59% had relief in the symptoms. Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Again, it's that whole idea of like, why aren't we studying what's going on with the body when it's trying to self heal? And then it brings up the question of, must we always have deception?
Yeah.
You know, is there any way to have the placebo response without some sort of, you know, curtain, you know, behind our understanding of what's going on?
Well, it seems like one way that it might is like even in listening to this podcast or even in researching this podcast, we get this idea that, ooh, there's, I hate to mystify it at all, but you kind of get this mystic idea of, oh, what is a placebo doing?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, what is my mind doing when I take a placebo? And then it becomes this possible, that you get this possible expectation in your mind that even if you take something that doesn't work, that it might work, you know, like that becomes the new placebo, the new fiction for the placebo to work within.
But see, that's why I think it's so fascinating, because I think that, you know, in an evolutionary sense, have we always had to construct some sort of fiction in order to pull through? Do you know what I'm saying? Is it something that's,
it's interesting,
that comes out of evolution?
Well, interestingly, you should ask that, because there is a guy by the name of Matt Rossano, who's professor of psychology at Southeastern Louisiana University.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called Supernatural Selection, How Religion Evolved. And this is basically his argument. All right. First, he says that our ancestors developed complex social structures to cope with a harsh, unforgiving world. You know, they're giant mammals everywhere eating everything. I have to work really hard to scrape by, and then I'm going to die when I'm really young, probably eaten by a large mammal. It's a rough world. So you end up with this social structure emerges, and you end up with the hierarchy in the group, and
there's probably some sense of peace or some structure there that makes you feel better about the world.
Right. But you end up with this social structure, and so you're going to need people with more memory are going to be able to better navigate it. You're going to need a knack for symbolic thought to move through it. So nature begin selecting for imaginative children. The imaginative children are by natural selection are the ones that end up surviving because they're better suited to navigate these complex social relationships as adults. And since the more imaginative children are the ones that survive, they end up bringing this imagination into their adulthood, and this mm-hmm. births gods and spirits. So Rossano states that early religion was shamanistic. You know, it's like, you know, guys saying, oh, you got a headache here, suck on this frog. Your belly's bothering you. Well, draw this on your stomach and set on the stone. You know, things right. of that nature. Thrown in with some, you know, not to say that all ancient or traditional medicines are phony.
There's some medicinal yeah. plants that we know that are used in ancient medicines.
But still, humans, he argues that basically they had a healthcare system of ritual healing practices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some which may have worked and some that didn't, but there was no real way to tell in those days, right? But humans who participated in healing rituals were healthier thanks to the placebo effect and more likely to procreate, keeping the religion's evolutionary march in motion.
See, that's interesting because I read too that the placebo, again, it's highly effective for disorders that engage the higher cortical centers that generate beliefs and expectations.
Mm-hmm.
They interpret social cues and anticipate awards. And again, this is chronic pain, sexual dysfunction, Parkinson's and depression, for example, that really respond well to this.
But okay, but what if I'm kind of a hypochondriac? What if I am kind of a worrier? What happens then?
I don't know. I guess you kind of get, maybe you just get placebo effect, right?
But what if I just can't help but focus on those list of side effects?
Effects. Then you're going to fall prey to something called the nocebo effect.
The nocebo effect.
Yeah. And it's the...
Which we're not making up. That's not even... That's actual Latin.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is Latin for again?
If I'm remembering correctly, it's like something
to
like...
To do harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And placebo is Latin for to please, I believe.
Yeah.
But nocebo effect is basically like the dark side of placebo effect. So think of it. If you are anticipating getting better
mm-hmm.
and getting relief... But you're told that the drug that you are given is going to have side effects and you're going to vomit and you may have erectile dysfunction. Guess what you're going to be doing?
Vomiting and having erectile dysfunction.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So that's difficult, right? And that's particularly difficult in terms of, I guess you could even say ethics if you're dealing with someone who is seriously sick. And I don't know if they do this with cancer treatments. I imagine that they probably do because they need to test it, right?
Yeah, you have to test it. You need a control group.
Yeah, you need a control group. And if you're in that control group and you're getting the placebo and you're awfully sick already, and then on top of that, you're getting other side effects, that's where some doctors are saying, okay, that's not very cool. I mean, we do need to have the control group and we do need to study this. But, you know, it is obviously the dark side of the nocebo effect.
There were some doctors that, like early on, they thought that this was caused because people were worrying as they're taking the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so their stomach's releasing enough acids to cause pain.
Right.
But they found that the range of possible nocebo responses stretched far beyond mere stomach aches. And what's more, they found that these nocebo effects weren't random. They tend to be specific to the type of drug that patients believe they're taking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, again,
so,
it's lining up with a group, with a list of possible side effects.
Yeah, I mean, imagine watching that commercial. I mean, we all know them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that endless list that goes on forever and ever. Blurred vision.
Yeah.
Wacky thoughts. You know, you are going to take all of that information. Your brain's going to absorb it. And just like your body can heal on its own with the placebo effect, it's going to say, okay, guys, buckle up. It's going to be a rough ride. Wacky thoughts ahead.
Yeah.
It's kind of nuts to think of it that way. But I also wanted to talk a little bit too. I mean, we've talked about the placebo effect and how cool this is. And obviously it bears so much more studying, but this, you know, I just need to caution that this is not a reason to actually quit your meds.
Right.
This is not anything that we're advocating. It's just an interesting paradigm shift on medication and on the placebo effect and looking at that a little bit closer. So just wanted to add that because obviously if you were to, especially with antidepressants, if you were to get off of them, you'd have horrible withdrawal symptoms. Also, each person is unique to their medication and to their condition. So, there you go again.
Yeah. Don't stop your medications.
Don't
don't make any medical decisions based on what you hear in this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. You should always consult with your doctor.
Yes.
Speaking of whom, you know, perhaps this isn't the best place to throw this information out, but I did want to mention that how widespread placebo effect is. And this is from one study, and albeit it's one study, it's in Chicago from 2007. There were doctors that were surveyed there, and they were asked about whether or not they had ever prescribed the placebo effect, or rather, I should say, had they ever prescribed something that they knew wasn't necessarily going to work for their patients, mm-hmm. or it was at such a low-level dosage that it wouldn't do anything in order to induce the placebo effect. Half of those doctors had done that.
Now, they didn't actually write placebo on the slip.
No. Yeah, yeah. Fake pills, I think, is what they wrote.
My mother-in-law frequently uses the placebo effect on my brother-in-law's kids. They'll have complain there because you know they're kids, so they're always complaining of something. And she'll get like gummy vitamins. And so it's like you've got a stomachache. Oh, your head hurts. Here, take one of these, and it works like a charm. They're just gummy vitamins.
That's I will have to put that in my back pocket.
Yeah.
For my 2-year-old.
They'll be very warm if you keep them in your back pocket, though.
Yeah, but yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. The kids like a good warm gummy bear.
Okay. Maybe not. But you know, here we go. I mean, this is just an interesting time to look at this information. Oh, and I wanted to also mention too that drug companies are paying, as I said, huge attention to this right now. And typically they have been really, covert about their operations, and they haven't let a lot of their data out of the bag, so mm-hmm. to speak, but they actually are pooling together and trying to get a study of the placebo effect and pooling their research, all the drug companies, which is pretty interesting. And I believe the NIH is also heading this up. So it'd be interesting to see in the next couple of years what sort of data they get out of this.
Yeah.
And also,
we're talking about a lot of money.
You're talking about a lot of money. This. And they also know that some of their big marquee sellers like Prozac mm-hmm. may not actually cut the mustard these days if they were to, because they actually retrialed some of these just for fun and noticed that the Prozac is actually not as effective as it was once deemed. And again, this could be because the placebo effect is becoming more rampant in trials. But there you go. Don't get off the Prozac, though.
Yeah. Stay on it if you're on it. But again, check with your doctor.
Absolutely.
Well, hey, we have some interesting feedback here from some listeners. Our first bit of mail comes from Oladeli, one of our listeners. Oladeli writes, "Hi, listen to your podcast where you talk about the robot singularity and how this creepy one about cyber immortality. So it gets one thinking, what if my memories representing past actions and experiences and Myers-Briggs profiles used to generate new actions and experiences were mapped to a robot's sensory inactions system? So surely buried deep in all that information and blueprint for future actions, the robot could act independently. I reckon it could sort of understand and hence work towards my goals and play out a version of me which would be based on me but different from me, independently of me. Could it then compete with me for my friend's attention or be jealous of me if it got to know me, or would I be jealous of it? Would that be considered singularity of some sort?"
I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, you know that there's been an intranet created for robots, right?
Yep.
And if you splice the singularity with that, then you could very well have your robot self hacking your Facebook account and taking you over. You're right.
Wow.
And your cyber presence.
Suddenly liking things you don't like going off on its own.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah, kind of trolling you. I mean, I kind of jest, but I mean, just to extend out that logic, it's kind of interesting about what... how all those parts might work together.
Yeah, some good brain fodder there. And speaking of the Cyber Immortality podcast, we received a lot of cool comments from folks who really dug that. And, you know, we can't read them all, but I have a bit here from a listener by the name of Crystal. And Crystal relates that she'd lost a friend. And then goes on to add, "Since that point, I have not been able to check my voicemails because my inbox is literally full of messages from this individual, built up about a week while my phone was out of minutes. This has really been bothering me lately, and then I listened to the Cyber Immortality podcast. It gave me a whole new perspective on the digital bit of information I have of this individual. I am happy to report my inbox is now empty. Well, I saved a few of them, and I have you guys to thank for it. Thanks a lot. By the way, then she had something else. But anyway, that's the key bit that I thought was really interesting. Obviously a lot of people are having to take the digital realm into account when dealing with the deaths of friends and loved ones these days. And it was really interesting to hear some tidbits from a few different listeners about this.
Yeah, we did. We had some really nice email about that, and people who had, like Crystal, talked about ways that they were revisiting actually people they had lost online. So
yeah,
some very interesting stuff.
And if you have any cool feedback to give us, if you have some interesting stories about your own experiences with placebos, for instance, we would love to hear about them, or your own thoughts on placebos, or if you're a doctor of any kind or you know, engaged in the medical industry or the pharmaceutical drug industry, let us know. Shoot us an email or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd blow the mind on both of those.
Yep, and again, if you're a big pharma, you can always rant to us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi. This is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.